This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
Mark Twain is supposed to have said there are three kinds of lies: lies, damned lies, and statistics. We are going to talk about damned and dangerous lies, I think, that we tell ourselves. We will fix climate change later, after we burn more fossil fuels. It is the myth of overshoot, and it's found in every climate agreement, official report, and business briefing books. Our guest, Wim Carton, studied it all, from new technology to the history of believing humans can rebuild the damaged atmosphere. He is the expert with dozens of papers and book chapters on carbon capture, geoengineering, and climate risks. Dr. Carton is Associate Professor of Political Ecology and Senior Lecturer at Lund University in Sweden. Along with co-author Andreas Malm, Wim's new book is Overshoot: How the World Surrendered to Climate Breakdown. From Sweden, Wim Carton, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
A couple of decades ago, I recorded talks by Dr. William Rees in Vancouver. He had charts of fish in the sea and trees on land, everything showing humans taking far more than Earth can replenish. Rees and other ecologists called that overshoot. For this new book, what do you and Andreas mean by overshoot?
Yeah, so we talk about overshoot in a more narrow sense. You're right that the original meaning of overshoot is this kind of broader, you know, transgressing ecological boundaries that comes out of the especially ecological literature. We're talking particularly about crossing temperature targets. So within the climate literature, there's a whole conversation on overshoot, and there it means specifically going beyond thresholds that have been set by political leaders, of course. That's the kind of, you know, crudest, most simplest form of overshoot. But then if you dig a little bit deeper into this literature, there's also something that is kind of ingrained in how all of these pathways and attempts to kind of, you know, come up with ways of reaching temperature targets have come about, and all of them rely on what we call overshoot and return, or programmatic overshoot. And this is the idea that what we can cross these temperature limits and then in the future use technologies to bring it back down to them by lowering temperatures again. So we play with this kind of double notion of overshoot and overshoot in return.
In your book, you do talk about three ways that this kind of spreads out. You say, in a way, it lets us accept that we're going to go beyond the safety limits, and it involves the belief that we will come back down, and then, of course, well, will it work at all?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, so we talk about this in terms of overshoot ideology, in the sense that, you know, it's become this kind of widely accepted idea that, you know, we will be able to do this, and that this is in a way the only way to do it, right? The only way to, you know, reach these ambitious mitigation climate targets is to go through overshoot. That's become like the dominant idea, and it's a belief that is based on what we call this kind of unicorn technology. Right, it's a widespread of contraptions, I mean, both technological but also natural, that can suck CO2 out of the atmosphere. And the whole problem with that is exactly that they, for the most part, continue to justify and legitimize business as usual. So they kind of just provide an excuse to, you know, just keep going in the meantime, right? So the kind of fantastical nature of these technologies justifies this notion that we can just continue with business as usual in the near term.
In an article in The Conversation, you and Andreas say, quote, "Mainstream climate science endorsed the fantasy of a global warming time machine." So are you saying even top-level science, like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change experts, bought into overshoot?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in many ways, overshoot in its kind of, you know, temporary crossing overshoot and then coming down again comes out of exactly this literature. So if you go back in time to, you know, some of the kind of the first IPCC reports in the early 2000s, so around the fourth and fifth, that's the report, then it's exactly there that the whole notion of overshoot came about in a way. So, I mean, what happened essentially is that at a certain point, political leaders came up with this 2-degree temperature limit, and then they went to scientists in particular a group of modelers called integrated assessment models that are very kind of central in the work of the IPCC, and ask them to, you know, provide ways of reaching these 2-degree targets. And we can talk a lot about the details here. I'm not going to go into too much of it, but the models work in a very particular kind of neoclassical economics way that is, you know, rather conservative in terms of boundaries that it works within. And so within those boundaries, they could not stay within 2 degrees because the model didn't allow for sufficiently rapid, I mean, capital destruction, for example, phasing out fossil fuel. All these things were not possible within the limits of that conservative model. And so what they had to do to kind of square that circle was to come up with overshoot. And this is where it originated, and then it got mainstreamed after the Paris Agreement. And from there, fed back into policy, and now I would argue also in a lot of like corporate reports and so on. So sadly, you know, part of the scientific community is definitely part of it.
And you look back into the history of this kind of thinking, right back to the 1970s, and I found it interesting that at that time, they were quite willing to say, well, look, this is a way we can keep on with our fossil fuel burning if we just have this overshoot idea.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is, in this book, Overshoot, that just came out, right, we talked about this particularly in terms of carbon capture and storage. So this original technology to put a carbon capture device on a fossil fuel power plant, for example. And in many cases, and this is still the case at the moment, right, this was meant to just, you know, produce CO2 that could then be pumped back underground to basically extract more oil and more gas because you increase the pressure. And that's been one of the main ways of CO2 capture at a chimney for most of the history of this technology, actually. Could we have a second book coming, actually, it's going to be released next year, that delves much deeper into all kinds of other technologies as well, not just carbon capture and storage, but also these newer ones. And even there, if you go back to the 70s, right, it's very interesting how all of the kind of narrative in the 70s, 80s, and 90s was about how do we find ways to continue pumping and combusting fossil fuels by time, essentially, because mitigation, rapid phase-out, was just not seen as conceivable or politically desirable. So all these technologies had this at the core of their development narrative.
And then we had a series of pretty serious reports. I reported on them into the supposed safe limit of 1.5 degrees C of warming and the predictions it would come in the 2040s. And then that was sort of moved to the 2030s. And now the last 12 months are already over 1.5 degrees C. What is the next limit being proposed? And what do these limits mean? Is there any point to it?
This is a very good question. It's very hotly debated at the moment, even among scientists. I know just the other day there's been a few papers by people either trying to, you know, dismiss and downplay the role of these limits, and then others kind of fiercely defending them. So it's a very active debate. I guess there's two things here. I mean, one is that politically the 1.5-degree target has had, it's been a Trojan horse for overshoot and for carbon removal. That's very clear now. But it's also had this enormous catalyzing effect, right? It came out of the demands of small island states and developing countries. It was picked up by the climate movement. In many ways, the kind of cresting of the climate movement after 2018 with Fridays for Future and so on was a result of this kind of momentum that built around, you know, this whole, I mean, also with, the special report on 1.5 degrees and so on. One can't deny that they've had a catalyzing effect. But they kind of create this notion of after 1.5 degrees, everything is, you know, either lost or, and that's of course not the case. There's everything to fight for after 1.5 degrees as well. I mean, politically, I guess we see the COP is happening as we speak, the Conference of Parties, the UN negotiations on climate change in Azerbaijan, and 1.5 is still kind of being held on to. Right, if you look at Paris. Obviously, the next limit is 2 degrees, but there's no reason to, you know, think that after 1.5, we just have to accept that 0.5-degree many people say every tenth of a degree matters, and in many ways, of course, it does. And this is also what the special report by the IPCC very clearly showed, right, after in 2018, that, you know, 1.5 was important because the difference between 1.5 and, for example, 2 degrees is very, very significant in terms of extreme weather events. And now we also know increasingly the risk of tipping points, you know, the AMOC, for example, or, you know, the Amazon rainforest potentially reaching a point of collapse. It's not a cliff that you kind of fall off of as you cross it.
Alex will be right back with more on the myth of overshoot.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We return to Dr. Wim Cardin on the dangerous myth of climate overshoot.
There must be supporters of overshoot. Who benefits if climate agreements depend on overshoot and governments go along with that?
I mean, the very clear answer is that the Saudi Arabias of this world and the, everybody who has stakes in continuing to extract oil and gas a little longer, those are the clearest beneficiaries, I would say. Because, the more we think that overshoot is the pathway that is going to bring us there, the more that we postpone phasing out of fossil fuels into the future, the more profit they can make in the meantime, of course. So they are the main people benefiting. And then, you know, the political class that is tied to that in many ways, in the case of Saudi Arabia very directly, but of course, even in a country here like Sweden, you know, there's a lot at stake when it comes to these very rapid decarbonization pathways. They're very unpopular, particularly by politicians on the right hand of the political spectrum, of course. They benefit from this as well.
Yes, you don't have to tell your voters that they're going to have to really cut back on fossil fuels because we'll fix it later. And that is almost the nature of politics, is to say we'll fix it later if they can. There is a growing chorus questioning overshoot, though. Wim, did you see the new paper in Nature led by Carl Friedrich Schleusner? It's titled Overconfidence in Climate Overshoot. Does that fit in with your work?
It really does, yeah. I mean, and this is actually a big part of it that we don't touch on in this book, but that we will have a lot to say about in the next book, and that's the whole question of tipping points, of course. And I mean, what this new paper does is it shows very clearly that, I mean, firstly, you know, there's no guarantee that once we cross 1.5 degree or whatever limit we set, that we will be able to come back. There might be feedbacks or mechanisms being set in motion that mean that the climate system kind of takes on a different dynamic that means it becomes very difficult to kind of wind temperatures back again. That's one risk. I think the broader issue here is that whatever happens once we cross 1.5 degrees and in a potential scenario where we suck CO2 out of the atmosphere and lower temperatures again, maybe on a global average, that's going to be kind of a similar world in terms of, you know, temperatures, but regionally and in terms of ecosystem impact, it's very different, of course. I mean, you might have had species going extinct, all kinds of things will have happened, so the world will look very different, so the two are not the same. And the second part is that, you know, these technologies, carbon dioxide removal, which we would have to rely on to be able to bring us back after overshoot, they are, as I already said, you know, there's a lot of problems with it, but also, I mean, the scale at which we would need to do this raises a whole lot of questions, and so there's really a lot of skepticism within the scientific literature about the ability or even the desirability of doing this at the, you know, very large scale.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest from Lund University, Dr. Wim Cardin. We are talking about the myth of overshoot and return in world climate. In your book, Overshoot, you and Andreas work through many lives of it, from economics through possible manipulation of the public. Did you consider the psychology behind such a dangerous giant mass delusion?
Not explicitly, but there's been, this is maybe a gap there there's a bit more on this also in the second book, where we go a bit into kind of psychoanalysis, because, and we set this up a little bit, right? We talk about this kind of madness. I mean, it's hard to understand this continued move towards what becomes every day more clear is a very dangerous world and a very dangerous future in purely, you know, economic analysis, for example, which is what the kind of theoretical framework which we use in the book. So you almost need psychology to help us understand this, as you say, mass delusion.
Well, I just wanted to suggest you could add a religious angle to Overshoot, because religion builds on the human ability to believe in things that may or may not exist without proof. You do call fossil fuels a demon. And just for fun, I asked an AI, what do demons intend? And it listed five characteristics, and they're so spot on. I want to quickly read them to you. The first is temptation, leading humans into sinful behavior or away from virtuous paths. Possession, taking control of a human body or mind to cause harm or chaos. Deception, spreading lies or falsehoods to confuse people. Corruption, influencing individuals to engage in immoral or unethical actions. And finally, infliction of suffering, causing physical, emotional, or spiritual pain to individuals. That sure sounds like fossil fuel addiction to me. What about you? Is it a demon?
Yeah, that's fantastic. It's spot on. That's a very sound analysis, I would say.
So, again, in ancient Greece, when they had a messy ending for a play, the only way they could resolve it was with a god. So they dropped a god or goddess figure onto the stage, maybe with a crane of some sort. And that's the origin of the expression Deus ex machina, God from the machine. And that is kind of how I see Overshoot. It's like a contrivance to save us that may or may not exist. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it is. And it may be, I mean, it goes for Overshoot as such, and even, you know, for these carbon removal technologies, maybe most of all for this notion of solar geoengineering, which is also attached to this whole idea of Overshoot. I mean, so the idea is that, you know, while we work our way across and then back from these temperature limits, we will somehow use a sulfuric shield in the sky to kind of temporarily dampen temperatures, and this will somehow help us maintain a livable climate while we suck the CO2 out of the air. And this is being discussed increasingly. There's a lot of political interest building in solar geoengineering, actually, concerning a lot of philanthropic and private capital flowing into research on this. And there, I think we have a god from the machine, if ever there was one, because there's a lot to say about that technology.
And suppose we give up the idea of Overshoot. Where does that leave us, and when it comes to life-saving climate action and carbon reductions?
I mean, I think it just brings home this absolute necessity of, I mean, we talk about asset stranding in this book, right? This need to grapple with this enormous amount of fossil fuel capital that is fixed in infrastructure and, in cars and everything. And we need a political program to basically strand that in a way that is not socially destructive. And that's the kind of main it's a very, very big task, of course. But it all comes down to, and this is a struggle that we continue to see at the UN negotiations and everywhere, right? That we need to move the message away from dealing with emissions and so on, to phasing out fossil fuels as soon and as rapidly as possible, because all of these kind of end-of-pipeline solutions come with so many uncertainties and risks and, misuse, that the simplest and, of course, the most politically unattractive solution as well is to just, get rid of these fossil fuels. Now, I mean, I do want to say, Andrea and me are not against kind of trying to use. So, I mean, the moment we have managed to do this and we have, stranded the fossil fuel assets that need to be stranded, and we have won the battle on mitigation, and, we're well on our way down to zero emission. We're not against exploring the idea of some kind of carbon removal solution. Some exist. They have problems. But if we manage to kind of minimize them, there's, of course, no reason not to explore them at a later point. It's just that at this moment in time, the function that they fulfill is the one that we explore in the book, and that is this kind of fantastical kind of, we can continue to do whatever we're already doing because we have these alternatives. So we need to, I think, distinguish between the use of these technologies at different moments in time. In a utopian future, you know, there might be a use for them, but we're just very far away from that at the moment, and therefore something else needs to happen first.
Now, a couple of chapters in your new book cover rapid-fire climate disasters that are developing all over the world in the 2020s, and they come so fast, nobody can know about them all, and then we forget when the next one comes. And that sad list continues to accumulate in 2024. Why include that in a book about overshoot?
I mean, we struggled a little bit with this because, as you say, there's no end to this, right? One of the challenges with writing a climate book, when you know publications happen a year after we actually finished writing it. So, I mean, so much has happened in this last year, including, as you have said, you know, all of these more than 1.5 degree record temperatures globally, inevitably setting yourself up for having a very outdated list of disasters. I think we see somehow a normalization or even a numbing toward these disasters. And it's very easy, if you read the mainstream media, to not be confronted with them anymore because, you know, especially with it happening in the global south, often, you know, they're not being reported on. I think people just need to be reminded that this is our everyday reality already now. This is not something that is, you know, going to happen in some kind of distant future. Climate disasters are here, and they're already affecting a whole lot of people. So that's the main reason why we really, you know, wanted to put this front and center. This is ultimately why it matters, right? People's lives are at stake. People's livelihoods are at stake. And I think we need to keep that in mind with everything that we do when it comes to climate.
Yes, there were 4 typhoons hit the Philippines in the last 2 weeks, and that didn't even make it into the news around here. You wouldn't know it. So then you and Andreas explore a kind of last-ditch, tiny drop of hope. Maybe a great breakdown will open a door to real and necessary changes. I kind of went into this in a 2016 show that I called Can We Count on Catastrophe? And my guests there warned breakdowns don't always lead to a new dawn at all. Talk to us about your considerations about finding hope in crisis.
That's a very good point, and it's something that we've really talked a lot about. We just felt that at a certain point, you know, one has to think, okay, what would the alternative actually be? If we take this kind of asset stranding strategy seriously, it would entail some kind of massive breakdown. We see very often that in times of crisis, there's a moment opening up for what you could call a social tipping point, something happening very rapidly. Those are moments in which, you know, real change can actually occur. And the right has, you know, very often been very successful at kind of utilizing these, right? At what Naomi Klein calls the kind of shock doctrine. But there is absolutely, as you say, no guarantee that, you know, in a moment of crisis, especially not if you, you know, try to trigger it, you can control what happens next and that, you know, the outcome will be in any way desirable. It is maybe even likely that the opposite would happen. I mean, we acknowledge very clearly in the book that we don't have any kind of recipes for what to do. It's obvious that this kind of lightning bolt strategy is a kind of a last-ditch attempt. I mean, for 1.5 degrees, as you already mentioned, it's maybe already too late. It's very hard to see what the alternative is because the amount of capital invested, I mean, the amount of money flowing into fossil fuels is still growing. If you want to put a stop to that, you just need something very different from what is happening at the moment. The way we see it, a crisis is the only thing that could potentially deliver that.
As we wrap up our time here together, would you take a couple of minutes to tell us about your new book in the series, The Long Heat, Climate Politics When It's Too Late?
Yeah, happily. So this is a book that basically really follows up from Overshoot. And it two things. I mean, firstly, as I already mentioned, it and tries to explore the notion of reversibility. So as was indicated, for example, in that Meeker study, right, can we actually, once we cross 1.5 or whatever limit, can we actually come back to that temperature again? Is that possible within the current climate system? So we delve into that quite a lot and explore that. And secondly, we go into a lot of depth when it comes to these technologies for sucking CO2 out of the atmosphere. So we look at all of them and explore, you know, how are they currently being used, what is their potential, what are their drawbacks, and might there be some kind of progressive potential from them. And what we find very clearly is that, I mean, there's so many ways in which they're all being mobilized to, instead of, you know, sucking CO2 down permanently, to generate profit, either by, as I already said, enhancing oil recovery, or, you know, being used as offset, or, you know, to make synthetic fuels with the carbon that is being captured, or some other commodities. So we essentially, we talk about these three front lines. We say that after mitigation, after overshoot, the front lines of climate change are multiplying, and we will not have to struggle over only mitigation, but also adaptation, carbon removal, and geoengineering. And so we map what those struggles essentially will entail about, you know, how do we use these technologies, how are they going to be used by the people in power, and what indications are there already of this happening. That's what this second book is about.
From the University of Lund in Sweden, we've been speaking with Dr. Wim Carton. With Andreas Malm, he has just released the new book, Overshoot, How the World Surrendered to Climate Breakdown. This is not a narrow book for policy wonks. Our future is on the line. Find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Wim, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
The White House has become the East Coast branch office of ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal, and climate change has become the preeminent case study of the contamination of our political process by money.